Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up later.
This is a story that really needs to be told and that needs to enter the public consciousness. The main danger in an overly dominant finance sector, as it is in the UK, is that what you end up with is almost a kind of dictatorship of finance.
We talk to film director Michael Oswald about his new film, The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire. The film premieres in July. But first, here's a quick Tax Justice news roundup for this month. The Tax Justice Network and partners had a big campaign victory this month. The International Tax and Investment Centre isn't the neutral tax policy influencer it might seem. It's long been used by big tobacco to influence tax policy in developing countries, their big growth markets. Tobacco tax is one of the key tools to prevent unnecessary deaths. And after lots of negative publicity, the centre's now been forced to drop its tobacco board members and sponsors. You can find out more about those developments on www.taxtobacco.org. In Australia, the tax office is giving multinational companies a headache, a well-deserved one. After much fantastic campaigning by the Tax Justice Network in Australia, Chevron lost its appeal against the tax office in a case about its practice of significantly reducing its Australian tax liabilities through transfer pricing techniques. The company's appealing again to the nation's highest court, but the whole process has opened up a new front worldwide for tackling tax abuse in this area. The Aussie Tax Office is now targeting dozens of multinational companies, which they describe as being in the red zone when it comes to related party loans. There's been another offshore leak, this time to the German authorities, this time from Malta, often called the Panama of Europe. Details have been leaked on 70,000 offshore companies, including several German corporations and up to 2,000 German taxpayers. Malta's immersed in its own long-running scandal over allegations the Prime Minister's wife owns an offshore firm in Panama, which may have been used for tax dodging and possibly other fraud, claims they deny. He's now called a snap election for next month. Malta currently holds the European Union presidency, and to heap on the shame, a new report from journalistic network European Investigative Collaborations claims Malta's a big target for firms linked to the Italian mafia. Speaking of which, this month it turns out a mafia organisation, the 'Ndrangheta in Italy, have been stealing millions meant for refugee centres in southern Italy, meaning there wasn't even enough food for newly arrived people to eat. I wonder if that money's in Malta now. In Uganda, the former energy minister has admitted to Parliament that she signed a tax waiver agreement with UK company Tullow Oil without reading the document. That should only ever be the responsibility of the finance ministry, with a sign-off by the minister accountable to Parliament. A tragedy for Ugandans that should never have happened. And finally, on the TaxCast, we've been following progress with the Criminal Finances Bill going through the UK Parliament, with an all-important amendment which would force the UK's overseas territories to create public registers of the real owners of companies. Well, with the snap election called, that amendment has now been dropped. It won't be the last of it, we'll make sure of that. Those are the Tax Justice news headlines. Now we're going to talk to the Tax Justice Network's John Christensen for his take on this month. OK, John, this month in Britain, a sudden general election's been called, and quite interesting that one of the biggest debates has been around tax, which I can't remember in all of my voting life. We've had some interesting policies put forward by one of the opposition parties to tax the top 5% of earners a bit more, and things like raise corporation tax. Also, tax is really big in the US with Trump's refusal to publish his tax returns, and he's putting forward all sorts of help the rich and help corporations tax reform proposals. And so that's all the more interesting that if we take a look at Sweden at the moment, it seems to be booming. And at the heart of this boom seems to be, according to the finance minister, income redistribution as key to their economic success, and taxes a key tool in that. Sweden's economy has actually grown twice as fast as the United States last year. So a sort of a reverse Trumpism. Very interesting.
Yes, now I think maybe what we're seeing here are the final death throes of Tina. Tina says there is no alternative. This idea that came through in the 1980s, pushed forward by Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, that there was only one way to run an economy, and that involves cutting taxes, privatisation of public assets, deregulation, lower social protection generally, and the rolling back of state involvement in the economy. Now, the results have been unimpressive across the entire world. We've seen slower rates of growth and innovation in most European countries, falling income for many, greater inequality, rising social division, and a race to the bottom on social and environmental protections. Too many people have been missing out on the potential gains of globalisation. So it's really refreshing to hear a Swedish finance minister who calls into question some of the sacred myths that have shaped Tina, the idea that there is no alternative. But if we look at what's happened over the last three decades under the era of Tina, we see that the share of global income going to workers has fallen significantly in almost all countries, whilst the share going to capital, which of course is concentrated in the hands of a very, very small minority of people, has risen enormously. And this, I think, largely explains why globalisation has been blamed for so many of the big problems facing the world today. Sweden's national output has grown significantly faster than the US economy and most other economies. And in Sweden, the state's share of the economy has stayed relatively high at 43%, whereas in the USA, it's only 26%. Another figure to illustrate Sweden's success, Sweden runs a budget surplus. The US deficit for the next year is estimated at 5.8% of national income. And in Sweden, the income of the bottom 90% has doubled in the past 40 years, whilst in the USA, incomes have flatlined since the 1970s, and the wealthiest 10% of Americans have seen their wealth go through the roof. So there you have it, two very different stories. One of an Anglo-American development model, the one of Thatcher and Reagan. It hasn't worked. It's time to kill off Tina. And here you have a Swedish finance minister who's saying there's a very different model and our model is working.
You know, what people always say about Scandinavian approaches to tax and redistribution is, these are small countries. It's different. It's different for Sweden.
I don't see any reason why it should be different for Sweden compared to, say, United States or United Kingdom. There are some universals here. First of all, having weak labour in the United States has not led to either significantly higher rates of growth. It's just led to greater volatility, social inequalities, and there's no evidence at all of a higher rate of growth, even though, for example, the United States for the last 20 years has been leading the digital revolution. This hasn't been feeding through to the vast majority of people in the United States. So I don't think this is a matter of size. I think this is a matter of political will.
OK, let's talk about Crimea now, because interestingly, the Russian parliament is set to consider legislation that would turn Crimea into a tax haven, apparently. What on earth is going on here with Crimea?
Well, look, this is potentially a very serious and dangerous development. New plans coming out of Moscow to further transform Crimea into a secrecy jurisdiction and a low-tax, low-regulation tax haven. I say further because this process is actually started back in 2014, shortly after the Russians annexed the Crimea. In November 2014, the Russian president signed a federal law making Crimea a free economic zone with widespread tax exemptions, tax holidays, and reduced social and worker protections for investors investing into facilities in the Crimea. The corporate income tax rate was cut at that time to 6%, so it's a very, very low rate. Now, the new measures, which have yet to be presented to the Russian parliament, will significantly accelerate this process of turning Crimea into a secrecy jurisdiction, because the core proposals include provisions for international trusts, international companies, family foundations, and the ownership of these legal entities will be anonymized, so they will be totally secretive. Now, for tax purposes, these entities will be treated as non-resident, and they will not fall under the regulation of the Russian government. by now, anyone who understands anything about tax havens should see red lights flashing right the way across the board. Now, the architects of this tax haven Crimea are also pushing for the existing free economic zone to be extended into what they're calling an international transit zone that would exempt businesses operating from that zone from value-added tax, income tax, property taxes, all in return for an annual fee of just slightly over 1,500 euro. So that's a tiny, tiny sum, a fee rather than a tax. So if that sounds like a giveaway, that's exactly what it is. Now add to that proposal, further proposals to provide unspecified special incentives to foreign banks, to insurance companies, and to fund managers, including the possibility of operating in Crimea without any kind of Russian license, which means effectively no regulation. And you can see why these proposals add up to a right-wing libertarian's wet dream, or a criminal's wet dream, or both. For the rest of the world, this is another cesspit tax haven in the making.
Who would be interested in using Crimea in this way? I mean, is it not subject to sanctions and therefore very difficult to trade in and out of it?
Look, the effectiveness of sanctions depends entirely on how hard they're being applied. There are plenty of countries across the world that aren't applying sanctions to Russia or the Crimea. Plenty of people in the region, by which I mean Southwest Asia, Middle East and so on, quite happy to use fairly unregulated bolt holes where they can operate anonymously. Gangsters, lowlifes and carpetbaggers from around the world. This is potentially a really dangerous situation.
Wow. Apparently Crimea's Deputy Prime Minister has defended these proposals by talking about every major state, he said, has havens, and he talked about Delaware and the British Virgin Islands.
Well, he has absolutely every right to do that because, of course, for donkey's years, both the United States and the Western European countries have been going on about the need for market economies to be well-policed, well-regulated, blah, 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 blah. But, of course, they've all operated their own little bolt holes, whether it's the British Virgin Islands or Luxembourg or wherever. They've all been using these places for all sorts of very, very not dodgy and nefarious purposes. So it's total hypocrisy on the part of the West to point fingers at Crimea, because they themselves have been so criminal and cavalier in trying to solve this issue. Don't be surprised if others join in and do it worse. This is a very dangerous ratcheting down global standards.
John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. We're going to give you a sneak preview of a fascinating new film which premieres in July called The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire. This isn't only a film that all British people should see, what it has to say is also of huge global significance. So this month, the TaxCast talks to the film's director, Michael Oswald. Keep listening for details on how you can get to see the film.
The British soldier. All around the globe you'll find him, from Gibraltar to Hong Kong. Everywhere he stands against the threatening years, staunch symbol of our common will to order.
Tell me how you came to make the film, first of all.
So I read Nicholas Jackson's Treasure Islands, and I was intrigued by a number of comments in the book. One of them was a quote from Caden Hopkins' British Imperialism about the rise of the euro dollar market and, you know, connection with the British Empire and the City of London.
The British Empire. The largest empire the world has ever known. For over 300 years, Britain ruled, its armies conquered, and its bankers proclaimed the might of its currency. But one day, it all began to fall apart. One by one, countries declared their independence from Britain, and no amount of force could reverse the tide. As British elites saw their wealth, privileges, and empire disintegrate, they began to search for a new role in a changing world, and they found one in finance. This is a film about how Britain transformed from a colonial power to a modern financial power, and how this transformation has shaped the world we live in.
Let's talk about what you're bringing into this field that's different, because I think what's really interesting about film is that it really takes you on a historical journey of the transition really from a colonial empire to a financial empire. Really, really interesting, with a lot of old interesting footage as well.
Yes, imperial power to financial power and how it came about.
Yeah, I was thinking it's like a three-stage transition, you know, so you've got the colonial empire, financial empire, and then what's happening now, which is the financialisation process and the sort of deindustrialisation as the third stage. We seem to be in the third and final stage at the moment.
Yes, I think you could say that. What we're seeing now is kind of the outcome of the growth of this financial empire.
And I thought what was really interesting as well, which I didn't know, was I knew the UK was a huge global player, one of the biggest, if you include the satellite havens. But I didn't know that, you know, their slice of the global market was larger than the United States. They talk in the film about 19% share of the market for the United States and 25% for the UK. That was surprising.
Yes, and I think it's even more surprising if you consider the fact that although the 19% in the United States is mainly in New York, and obviously the United States is the largest global power, and the City of London has around 17%, and then together with its overseas dependencies, it's 25%. But obviously a lot of what happens in these overseas dependencies is actually decided in London. So London actually plays a much bigger part.
Another new kind of financial space began to emerge, far away from London, in Britain's overseas jurisdictions, the last remnants of empire.
Back in the 60s, the Cayman Islands was a complete backwater. There was nothing happening there.
Accountants and lawyers from London arrived in the Cayman Islands and other British dependencies and began to draft a set of financial secrecy laws and regulations.
What the Cayman Islands was doing was straightforwardly illegal activity. Drugs money was coming in huge quantities, tax evasion, whatever you wanted, you could have it.
The Bank of England was observing the developments from London and noted in a report marked secret, dated 11th of April 1969, "We need to be quite sure that the possible proliferation of trust companies, banks, etc., which in most cases would be no more than brass plates manipulating assets outside the islands, does not get out of hand."
Another really interesting thing that's explored in the film is the relationship between the United Kingdom and its overseas territories and its crown dependencies, you know, that are sort of funneling all this dirty money into the City of London.
And that's the fascinating aspect about this relationship, because deals are discussed in London and they're concluded in London, but then they're registered offshore. And so it's almost like it didn't happen in London. And so it doesn't have to follow the rules that London would have to follow being inside the United Kingdom.
And the sort of shrugging of the shoulders by the government saying, well, you know, this is terrible stuff that's going on over there, you know, but it's nothing to do with us and there's nothing we can do about it.
Yes, there's a whole game that is being played. And I think Nicholas Shackson explains that in the documentary very well. It's kind of a multi-layered thing. There are a lot of structures and interests, things that are happening in the background. For instance, John Christensen explains that how when he was an economic advisor to Jersey, he would fly to London, you know, almost on a weekly basis. And there would basically be informal discussions where he would meet someone at the Home Office or the Treasury and they'd have a cup of tea. And they would
British.
Yes. And then they would suggest, you know, what they liked and what they didn't like and what they kind of expected to happen. And so it's this informal control or informal influence is very interesting because we don't normally consider that element when we consider what the government is doing and how it's exercising power.
It's about providing a legal space in which you pretend activity is taking place. So you're taking activity from the place where it's regulated and taxed and pretending that it's happening elsewhere. Now, where doesn't really matter, it's just elsewhere.
Today, there are more banks in London than in any other financial centre.
In Britain, nobody goes to jail. No bankers go to jail. They generally don't. They are a protected species. And that is part of the offshore business model of the UK, is to say, we will protect you. Bring your money here. We will look after you. We're not going to put you in prison. We'll let you do what you want.
Before long, the offshore system developed into the world's dominant international financial market. Few were aware how this market functioned. In 1986, economist John Christensen went offshore to investigate. He applied for a position at the Jersey office of one of the world's major accounting firms.
But Deloitte & Touche, I was working in what's called company and trust administration, straightforward offshore stuff. I went offshore specifically to work in that area because that's where you're dealing with the offshore companies, the shell companies, the offshore trusts. That way I could see from working inside a big global accounting firm exactly what the clients were doing. And over the course of my period of working with Deloitte Touche, I investigated over 100 of their clients offshore, and this is what I found. There were some insider traders, some market rigging, some avoiding disclosure of conflicts of interest, illicit arms trading, illicit political campaign donations, contract kickbacks, bribery, fraudulent invoicing, trade mispricing, and at the bottom, tax evasion. Okay? This is what the clients were doing. On the basis of a sample of the clients that I looked at, not a single client was involved in what I would regard as genuinely legitimate activity. They were all involved in some kind of tax dodging or worse.
What surprised you the most when you were making the film?
And one of the things that surprised me was during a meeting with John Christensen, where he explained to me how trusts worked. He asked me to imagine that we were in Jersey and that we were going to set up a trust. And then he stuck out his finger and he said, now touch my finger. And I did. And he said, well, now we've set up a trust. We've made an agreement to set up a trust. And it was at that point that it struck me just how simple it was and how there was basically absolutely no oversight. It was just an agreement between two people. And then if you consider that there is possibly as much as 50 trillion of wealth sitting behind these trusts, it's quite unbelievable, actually.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned trusts, because that is a very specifically Anglo-financial offering to the world, which so far Britain has been very successful in protecting from any kind of transparency regulations.
Yes, really kind of the main offering that Britain has, these kind of trusts and the way that they can be hidden in, you know, and are organised and structured through multiple jurisdictions.
In Britain's offshore jurisdictions, anyone can set up a trust and act as a trustee. There is no registry of trusts. There are no bodies to certify that a trust has been set up.
The only persons who know about the creation of this agreement are the trustee and the settlor. There's no obligation to register it. There is no financial reporting obligation of trusts. They are not required to put annual statements onto account anywhere. So actually, trusts are, to all intents and purposes, invisible arrangements. We're not talking about a few million. We're talking now about trillions. Trillions of dollars of capital, which apparently belong to nobody. For tax purposes and for other purposes, they belong to nobody. Everything, works of arts, gold bullion, racehorses, cars, real estate, not just financial assets, but a whole load of non-financial assets belong to these trusts.
In many cases, it's the politicians and their cronies and their families and so on, and the business people who sponsor the political parties, who
are using these offshore services themselves. So they got no personal interest in closing it down. If they wanted to close it down, they could do it tomorrow. The fact of the matter is they don't want to do it because they themselves are complicit with the process.
This system has taken the place of the occupation, colonies. And when you look at the money flows through the tax havens, they are increasing when we withdraw from the colonies. We are still plundering developing countries as former colonial powers.
To what degree do you think British citizens understand this central role Britain plays in the global corruption story?
I'm not sure to what extent people understand this. We've screened the film to a number of people and a number of British people, and a lot of them are very surprised. And my personal view is that Britain hasn't really been able to shake off its empire era mentality and the modern tax haven empire, which is based on the colonial empire, is just one example of this. But there are many other examples of this. And probably what is at the heart of it is that although Britain lost its empire and the empire collapsed, what lay behind the empire, all the institutions and the elite, they were never challenged. You know, they stayed in place and they were never told that what they had done was wrong, you know, in terms of the torture and all those kind of things. Mm. And so I think that is a fundamental aspect of Britain which needs to come to light.
Seeing ourselves as exploiters, you mean?
In a way, just accepting history, accepting your role in history. Because obviously empires are always ruthless, but they always pretend that they are beneficial. And, you know, normally once an empire has declined, then another empire comes and it holds to account, you know, the individuals who perpetrated atrocities. In Britain's case, that didn't happen.
We've moved to what you could call stage three, I guess. We've had colonial empire, we've had financial empire, the second empire. Now we're in this financialization process where we're seeing, the finance curse in action. In other words, we've got a really, really dangerously overly dominant finance sector, which creates all kinds of problems and economic problems.
The British banks today, just as in the 19th century, don't put their money into British manufacturing. They put their money into real estate speculation, into financial speculation, foreign currency trade. So the financialization of London has helped deindustrialize the country because it's enabled sterling to be supported by this huge inflow of hot money, this inflow of drug dealing money and criminal money and tax evasion money, all over the world, that is going to London instead of going to Switzerland, Liechtenstein, or the Caribbean.
The main danger that I see in an overly dominant finance sector, as it is in the UK, is that this one sector is able to direct the narrative, so to speak, to say, you know, what should be done and how things should be organised. Obviously, the finance sector is going to ask for things which will be beneficial for itself, while claiming that this is beneficial for everyone. If you give it too much power, what you end up with is almost a kind of dictatorship of finance.
Right, and this feature of it as undermining democracy was highlighted in the Clement Attlee quote. It's all the questions about who the politicians are serving. The public interest, or are they serving a very, very small financial elite?
Over and over again, we have seen that there is in this country another power than that which has its seat at Westminster. The City of London, a convenient term for a collection of financial interests, is able to assert itself against the government of the country. Those who control money can pursue a policy at home and abroad, contrary to that which has been decided by the people.
In the UK, you know, Clement Attlee, he was a prime minister and he made that statement. Whereas I think today you wouldn't get a future prime minister or a person who was a prime minister making that statement. So we have come a certain way, you know, in adopting a certain reality.
Right, and it's almost become like an inevitability that this is today's reality and this is how things work.
Exactly, yes.
And it really is a psychological capture, not only political capture.
Yes, I agree.
We have country after country around the world where the lack of financial transparency about taxation, about ownership, about corruption has undermined the extent to which governments deliver representative policymaking for their citizens. You know, we have extreme cases like the hiding of tax evasion by people in finance ministries in Greece, in France. But we also have this system that in general is geared towards anonymous company ownership, the anonymous ownership of properties across London, of half of the land in Scotland. You know, do we really think there's any circumstances in which governments work better, in which markets work better, in which the distribution of income and assets is better when we allow so much to be hidden? Who wants to not know who you're doing business with? Who wants their government to have people working for it or to be led by people whose assets are hidden, whose financial transactions are conducted anonymously offshore? This is a bad direction for the world.
The main purpose of the film is to kind of raise awareness about how it works, and then hopefully people can make decisions and demand change. This is a story that really needs to be told and that needs to enter the public consciousness. I hope that it will reveal what is possible.
I've been talking to filmmaker and director Michael Oswald. His film, The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire, will premiere on the 5th of July at the Frontline Club in London. If you're not in the UK or in London, details on how you can see the film will be published on the film's website, www.spiderswebfilm.com. And you can follow the film's progress on Twitter too, on Twitter handle spiderswebfilm. You've been listening to The Taxcast. That's it for now. We'll be back next month.